I'd like to welcome you to the latest in our installment of Global Health Perspectives podcast. My name is Derek Yach. I'm at the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. We started these podcasts last year as the pandemic was starting. And we thought it would be interesting to keep talking during what we thought would be maybe 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, about how people's work, particularly related to smoking, intersected with their reality of living under a pandemic. Sadly, we were wrong in our assumptions about when we would be able to return to normal. And here we are in February 2021, facing a year when we still have rising caseloads in some countries, thankfully dramatically lowering caseloads in some countries, including here in the US and in India, and a great deal of doubt about how fast we can get the vaccines rolled out to give population protection. I think this period of uncertainty has bred a lot of anxiety, and along with anxiety and stress comes a reduction in physical activity, an increase in smoking and substance abuse, and unhealthy diets. And my hope is that by the time we end this year, hopefully well before, we will not only be vaccinated against COVID-19, but we'll be able to start taking steps to vaccinate ourselves against chronic disease risks that over the long term will prove to be more threatening to our health than even the pandemic has been. I'm thrilled to have with me my friend and colleague, Kotha Hajat, who has really spent her career focused on the full range of chronic disease risks, having been trained as a physician and a cardiovascular disease epidemiologist, and having really tackled these issues from many perspectives, from the focused work on obesity in the Middle East to the role of multiple chronic conditions and how we often neglect that at our peril, to some of the work looking at the quality of smoking and harm reduction studies. So Kotha, lovely to have you join me, and hope that you're staying safe in the UK.
It's been a real roller coaster of a year for public health and epidemiology. I don't think we've ever been in the limelight as much as we have this year. And as you rightly point out, chronic diseases really should be at the forefront of our discussions with COVID, because we're seeing that that really has been the driver for severe COVID.
Well, I wonder if I can just dig into that a bit and maybe tell us about your earlier work on obesity in the UAE and how that now intersects in pretty deadly ways with what we're seeing with regard to the pandemic.
Yeah, so the data that's been coming out this year shows that 9 in 10 of people who have severe COVID have at least one chronic condition. And particularly when we look, and age has been a strong driver too, but when we look at younger patients with severe COVID, so going into hospital, ITU, or sadly dying, around 2/3 of them are obese. And we're seeing a large proportion with what's termed morbid obesity, which is a very high clinical BMI. And so it's really, I think, brought to the forefront the importance of chronic conditions and risk factors, which, because they themselves are asymptomatic, we might ignore or not pick up and treat pretty badly on the whole. So things like obesity, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, until they go on and cause a disease endpoint, until they cause a heart attack or a stroke, or go on to full-blown diabetes, they tend to be a little bit ignored or not taken very seriously. And I think for the first time, we're seeing people who are not at the target age range for things like heart attacks and strokes, but are seeing how their risk factors and lifestyle behaviours have actually impacted on their risk for infectious disease at an earlier age.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that the work that we did on addressing adult health and asking the question, how do you intervene at age 50 and have material impacts a few years ago, is suddenly really crucial, because I think the one thing the pandemic has laid bare is the vulnerability of adult health when associated with these risks. Maybe you could just speak to some of those interventions that we could or should be accelerating at a global level.
Yes, so screening clearly comes into play at around age 50, because the risks for cancer prevention and early diagnosis often start around that age. But diet and physical activity really are the kind of cornerstones for healthy, for reducing lifestyle risks. And they start much earlier than age 50. So at around the age of 50, we start seeing that disease is manifesting. But really, there's a lifetime risk from poor diets and high BMIs and low levels of physical activity. Add to that tobacco use and alcohol use, and they really, I mean, tobacco use and excess alcohol intake over years and decades then manifest at the age of 50 or 60 and later, and we start seeing cardiovascular disease, cancers. So tackling all of those is crucial. You mentioned work that I did in Abu Dhabi, and that was really setting up a national program for all of those. So for screening, early detection, but then really looking at community level, what can we put in place to increase physical activity, increase awareness of the risks, to improve diet? So really looking at things like food labeling, looking at foods that are imported and allowed into the countries, for example, things like trans fats, saturated fats, and then making physical activity available, particularly in that region with the climate. How can we encourage physical activity, for example, in ladies who didn't have as many facilities for physical activity? So that was quite was a fantastic opportunity to put in a program with very little legacy before me. And we had huge impact. We had uptake in over 90% of the population in terms of screening. We had linked websites and the start of a personal health record to allow ownership of health. And that's one thing that we don't really talk about enough, getting individuals to really have more ownership and accountability for their own health.
Yeah, and just to mention the size of the population that you were dealing with, I mean, this was a pretty mega piece of work by anybody's standards.
It was, yes. So we screened 94% of the national population. So and the whole population there is around 2 million. So it was small enough to actually be manageable, but large enough to make an impact. And that part of the world we see have, all of the countries in the GCC have rates of diabetes and obesity within the top 10 globally. So, and those are coming down, which is really good to see. Partly due to measurement, better measurement, partly due to other countries' rates going up, but also partly due to awareness and programs like this. And then we, of course, worked together on some behavioral economics work to really look at how we can drive individuals to take up physical activity. And the impact, again, of small near-term rewards is huge. We saw increases in the WHO recommended levels of exercise by up to fourfold in people who were taking up the programs. And then we could actually extrapolate that to risks of later disease and even mortality. So great impact. And also what was interesting, and I think that was your theory to begin with, and it was great to look at the data to corroborate that, is that once individuals become physically active, that does drive, it acts as a trigger for other healthy behaviour. So it drives healthier diets, it drives individuals to more kind of screening and general healthier behaviour.
Yeah, I think that's still a theory I'd love to see expanded. And I think coming out of the pandemic, it's going to be so much easier to encourage people to increase their steps or go for a daily swim than to actually make profound changes. And there's a chance for real large scale thinking around that.
I think it's very timely to really see how we can opportunize on the higher awareness that people have right now.
One of the dark sides of the pandemic we've seen has been the spread of misinformation. And we've seen it with regard to vaccine hesitancy. We've seen it with regard to the origins of the virus, everything from towers, cell phone towers, and all sorts of extraordinary, spurious stories. And the combined effect of this, of course, has been spread and socially amplified through social media in a way we have never seen before, I think, with an ongoing pandemic. But I know underlying it is probably the need for high quality epidemiology to shine through, the truth, the best data to shine through. And this is obviously an area you've also been looking at in respect of another pandemic spread by misinformation, the concerns about nicotine being deadly or e-cigarettes being deadly. And I'd love your thoughts about what are you seeing about the quality of the science in the field of harm reduction? And is the misinformation justified by what the science is telling us?
Yes, it's really very unfortunate the level of misinformation right now on social media and even mainstream media around COVID. And never before have I seen such strong anti-vaccine sentiment. And I think all of us have a role to play in tackling that with better communication and better science that backs up the policies. And our role, I see, as advocates of health, is to both inform the public and inform policy. And it seems that policies are being informed directly by public opinion without as much influence from public health as there needs to be. And seems that the countries that have fared quite well are the ones that do have good and well-developed long-term public health infrastructure. And some of the Asian countries, I think, have done very well as a result. In the UK and the US, I think it has really highlighted some gaps in the public health infrastructure that urgently need to be tackled going forward, both in terms of pandemic planning, but also tackling the chronic disease, as we've talked about. So moving to tobacco, because of this, again, lack of a clear evidence base, I undertook two systematic reviews with Ricardo from the Centers of Excellence for Tobacco Harm Reduction in Catania. And in general, what we found was pretty sloppy science, very poor quality science. And I mean, issues that I think would not be, or the threshold of quality would not be tolerated, I don't think, in other fields of science. For example, not accounting for smoking cessation. Sorry, not accounting for smoking status, not accounting or properly recording the exposure. So, for example, if somebody is an experimental user, they would still be classified as a vapor in the same way as somebody who's a daily user. So, we really need more careful and nuanced recording of use of tobacco harm reduction products. And particularly for smokeless tobacco, grouping together of products from Asia with Sweden, which are completely different products with completely different safety profiles. But many studies, particularly the global meta-analyses, which at first glance you might think would be high quality because of their size or because they come from prestigious research groups, but actually the fact that they are reporting on combined products means that the results are almost invalid. We found, in general, conventional study designs being used in a way that's just not fit for purpose for looking at real world science. Very little consideration given to the causal pathways. So there are many large data sets, particularly for smoking and use of e-cigarettes, large data sets that record at some basic level whether somebody smokes or uses e-cigarettes, but actually no consideration given for the way that the association will be picked up. So if we consider causality in a large data set, it can be one condition or risk factor causing another, which is really what we want to identify. But there can also be reverse causation with what we're looking for actually having a reverse association in a large data set with common conditions. There can be an apparent association when there is actually no direct link, or there can be a common risk factor that leads to conditions. So if we take, we didn't look directly for initiation of smoking in people using vapes in adolescence, but if we think about an individual who may be taking more risks, they would both be more likely to take up smoking and e-cigarettes, but that is it's rarely accounted for in any of these studies. And so really what we found is a lot of bias in the studies. Focus on negative health outcomes, very little focus on any benefit from, particularly from switching from cigarettes to e-cigarettes. And really no focus on the bigger picture. And I think that's a conversation that it still needs to take place, whether we are willing to, we know now that most of the reduced risk products that we talk about are far safer than smoking cigarettes. So are we at a stage where we are willing to continue prohibiting smokers to have access to these safer products in order to quit smoking at the small risk of new uptake of some of these products by people who have never smoked? Now, that is a reality, but it's a small proportion of those who use reduced risk products. So what we found, our main focus was on looking at health outcomes for e-cigarettes and vapes. We found zero risk for morbidity for cardiovascular disease or respiratory disease. With mental health, we found no harm, but I think more work needs to take place for that, because it's quite a complex relationship between mental health and e-cigarette use. Mortality and cancer have not been studied because there is no real biological or plausible biological pathway. With smokeless tobacco, we found vast differences between Swedish snus, for which there was no harm whatsoever, and there is of course a larger meta-analysis on protection against Parkinson's disease from and some other neurological disorders. The studies from Asia, Middle East, Africa did show harm, of course, for mortality overall, and particularly for oral cancer related mortality, and also for cardiovascular morbidity. But what hasn't been studied is the harms relative to smoking cigarettes in that population. And in the US, we found quite mixed results with the same patterns of harm as for Asia, but far lower levels of risk. So we were seeing odds ratios of 1.5 as opposed to odds ratios of 10, 15 in Asia. And so, and again, no comparison to the risks from smoking cigarettes. So the vast majority, over 90% of people who use both e-cigarettes and also smokeless tobacco are former smokers or dual smokers. And so really, that's the valid comparison we need to make, the harms relative to smoking rather than harms relative to nothing, to not using anything. So I think there are some policy or some implications for policy from our findings. Particularly at it's quite timely now as here in the UK we are leaving the EU. We have left the EU, and so there's an opportunity now to review and revise the Tobacco Products Directive, both for Swedish snus, which at the moment is banned outside of Sweden, but also for e-cigarettes in terms of some of the aspects of regulation, nicotine levels, for example, which may be prohibiting people using them to quit. And so that's something that we should look at. The EU Commission issued a preliminary document that suggested strong evidence for e-cigarettes in causing cardiovascular harm, respiratory harm, poisoning, and injuries. But actually, our review does not support the findings of that. And I believe it's still open for consultation, so I hope some of our work will feed into that.
Yeah, and that's that Scheer report, isn't it? It's by the, and I, yeah, and I must say it was a pretty dismal piece of work from a epidemiological point of view. And I've seen some of the submissions, and I think somebody who's done Harm Reduction 101 would be able to make the changes needed. I think one of the fundamental things they failed to do was to use a comparison group of smokers. Which, as you stressed, that's the whole point of this harm reduction stuff, is to get the people off their killing combustibles or their toxic smokeless into that area. Yeah, I think that the problem, of course, going back to the misinformation issue, is that the more exciting the story is about a negative report that e-cigarettes cause X, Y, or Z, the more likely it is to be amplified, then showing no effect. Or modest effect, or safety, or protection, and I think that's something we're all going to be faced with going forward. I think that the COVID experience is interesting. It seems that Facebook is now taking steps to at least lower the weighting that gets given to less credible sources in your news feed. The question is how you do that systematically across social media, and don't leave it up to Facebook to decide what's credible. But have a community feed in and say these are the criteria that should be used.
Yes, it's a we've seen that with COVID, that those who shout the loudest seem to have more kudos, but that really needs to be addressed, and I don't know how that can be addressed. I know there are some algorithms that can check the credibility of the source, but that in itself is not enough. Do you have ideas on how that can be better policed?
Well, I'm just watching the bigger story of how people are dealing with the misinformation in the election in the US, or the misinformation about the vaccine. And I don't have a simple solution, but I know that the combination of computer scientists, digital experts, behavioral economists, and psychologists are coming together like never before to address it at the macro level. I think we've just got to make sure that we ask the question, who's at the table when the algorithms are written? We saw some pretty bizarre examples of how, if the algorithm is written, you could strike out whole populations from the system. But I think that's something for the future.
We seem to have gotten to a public debate about which vaccine is better in terms of efficacy, but actually, as I think we've discussed, they're tested on different populations, so they're not directly comparable. But moreover, the main message for me to put across, which hasn't been at all, is that all of the vaccines have shown in those who have been vaccinated almost zero hospitalizations and zero deaths. And that actually is the key marker. That's what we're aiming for, is for severe COVID to be tackled, not. So this is something that will be endemic. We will not get to zero COVID, but we want zero severe COVID, and all of the vaccines are equally good at achieving that.
Yeah, and I think that's a great note to end off, and remind people that don't listen to the details of A versus B versus C. Listen to the fact that these vaccines all will give protection against severity and death. And the second thing to remember is my colleague, Slim Abdul Karim from South Africa, has been all over the BBC and the World News reminding us of the equity issue, that we need to make sure that the vaccines are available to the most vulnerable people and countries around the world, something which is not happening. I meant to end at this point, Kotha, and say it was wonderful to re-engage have you on this podcast. We will obviously have lots more to talk with going forward. And for those who want more information, please contact us at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And as you heard from Kotha, if the vaccine becomes available, take it. In the meantime, keep going with your mask and your physical distancing. And hopefully in a few months, we'll be able to start enjoying social interaction again. But thank you again.
Thank you, Derek.